I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are more questions today about President Bush's plan on Iraq, including how long is a surge?
We'll have to see in terms of the length of time. It's really hard to say at this point. It's viewed as a temporary surge, but I think no one has a really clear idea of how long that might be.
That's Secretary of Defense Robert Gates this morning responding to reporters' questions about the president's plan to send 20,000 more troops to Iraq. The president also proposed spending more money on reconstruction, cracking down on weapons coming in from Iran and Syria, and urging the Iraq government to arrest militants from all sects. The president is going on the road to try to sell his plan to soldiers. He's having lunch with troops at Fort Benning, Georgia, and members of his cabinet are testifying before senators on Capitol Hill. It's a busy day. We want to start looking at it with Dimitri Sevastopoulou, who's the Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dimitri, first of all, have you heard anything more about how long this surge will last?
I haven't, Robin, but I think the reason for that is we genuinely don't know. What I think the Bush administration is pinning their hopes on is that the government of Prime Minister Maliki, in combination with the extra Iraqi troops and the extra U.S. troops, will actually be able to achieve some significant progress on the ground before the momentum, or the public opinion momentum in the U.S., turns so strongly against the war that, you know, a growing number of Republicans feel like they need to come out publicly and tell President Bush they don't agree with what he's doing. And that would be, I think, the kind of the end game for President Bush and something he wants to avoid.
Well, and also, I don't know if you find this unusual, but in the coverage over the last day since last night, we've been hearing from many active soldiers who are speaking out about their disappointment with the plan.
Well, I think that the problem is that you have, when you have people like Colin Powell, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who was Mr. Bush's Secretary of State, when you have the Iraq Study Group, when you are told that General Abizaid and Casey, the top two commanders overseeing the Iraq war, who will soon leave, all oppose a surge, it's very difficult then to get the troops to sign up to it. And I think that's one of the problems that President Bush is going to face, is that there's huge opposition to this. And actually, you notice that there are actually some Republicans have come out on the Hill to support it, but their support has been quite tepid.
Well, let's talk about the troops. It was confusing today. At one point in his press conference, Secretary of Defense Gates said troops are in Iraq 1 year on, 2 years off. But then he said that's not the reality. So was anything new announced today about deployment? And by the way, he was speaking of active troops. Who's going to make up this surge? Is it going to be active or guard and reserve primarily?
Well, the two things happening. I think what the Pentagon wants is to have for active troops to have 1 year in the field, 2 years back home, for guard and reserves to have 1 year in Iraq and 5 years back home. They're saying they're going to strive to essentially maintain that policy, which is already stated policy. But then he went on to say, but there would be exceptions, because if you don't have exceptions and you don't mobilize the guard and reserves, it's going to be impossible to relieve the current stress on the force, which, by the way, is a huge repudiation of what Donald Rumsfeld said all along, which is that they had enough troops and the size of the army was significant or sufficient. In terms of where the troops are going to come from, there's one brigade, the 82nd Airborne Division in Kuwait, who will go in immediately. There are several other brigades in the U.S., army brigades, who will go in over the next few months. And then the Minnesota National Guard, who's already in Iraq, will have their return to the U.S. postponed by several months.
And Dimitri,
that's how they'll make up the numbers.
And before we move off this topic, I mean, just the idea of the 1 year on, 2 year off, I mean, the families we've spoken to, and we're going to speak to one later in the program, say that's never been a reality, or at least recently.
No, it hasn't been a reality. I mean, it's been what the Pentagon has always said that they want to do, but the reality of the situation on the ground in Iraq has meant that they haven't been able to achieve that. And I think what Mr. Gates is trying to do is to say that we really want to do this, but you're going to have to bear with us while we get enough troops, while we increase the overall size of the Army and the Marines so that we can actually return to our stated policy.
Okay. Well, during later questioning today by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Condoleezza Rice spoke about Anbar province. This is what the White House says is the al-Qaeda stronghold. And she said the tribal leaders there are fed up with al-Qaeda and have sent 1,100 men to Jordan for training. They're being called the Sons of Anbar, and they're going to fight alongside American troops. Your thoughts, Dimitri, and what the military is telling you on how well troops are going to be able to, including these troops, to fight alongside American troops?
Well, I think what everyone will tell you is that the proof is in the pudding. The Iraqi forces are clearly getting better. They're clearly increasing in size and number. but it's whether they will be capable of, when they're in actual operations, of putting down insurgencies, or if it's in Baghdad, of actually clamping down on militias, remains to be seen. In the past, they've failed. Anbar is interesting. There are clearly al-Qaeda elements there. But you remember there was a leaked Marine intelligence report a few months ago which said Marine commanders had concluded that Anbar was unwinnable. So I think it's still not clear whether success can either be achieved in Anbar or Baghdad.
Dimitri Savastopoulou covers the Pentagon and intelligence for the Financial Times. He's having a busy day. Thanks for spending some of it with us.
Not at all. You're welcome.
Well, joining us here in the studio now is Dr. Owen Cote. He's Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's going to be with us quite a while today. In a moment, we're hoping to hear from neoconservative Richard Perle, who'd been called an architect of the war in Iraq, although he doesn't like that title. But Dr. Cote, thank you so much for starting with us. We all knew going into last night that President Bush, you're nodding, was going to talk about the surge. It's one of the greatest leaks ever. So did he make his case for the surge last night?
I think the question about the surge that still remained to be answered before last night was, okay, you're going to add, it turns out, 20,000. That's the number that was leaked. What are you going to do with them and the forces that are already there that's different from what you've been doing before? And I think that a lot of the reaction to last night's speech indicates that people, and I have the same reaction, there isn't a lot of new approaches to using the, it's kind of more of the same. We're going to add, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a minute, a relatively small force, smaller than most of the advocates for a surge have asked for, to a city of 6 million people, and hope that we can do more of what we've been trying to do up till now with this force. And so I think that's one of the reasons why there's been a lot of skepticism.
What are the questions that you have outside of, well, what's going to be different with the troops? What other questions do you have as an analyst?
The big question I have about going forward the way that he's talked about is what is the Bush administration's view of the long-term prospects for the al-Maliki government? This is being described in a lot of ways as being an attempt to shore up the Maliki government. But at the same time, there's discussions about asking the Maliki government to do things which we've been asking them to do for a year,
right,
that are going to be very hard for it to do.
Well, let's stay with that question and bring into the conversation Richard Perle. He has been called one of the architects of the Iraq War, though he dislikes that label. He's a former chair of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and a longtime advocate of regime change in Iraq, who has recently been critical of the White House's implementation of the war. He's also a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Other AEI fellows were instrumental in shaping the president's new way forward. So, Richard Perle, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's put that question right to you. First of all, what do you think of the plan? And as Dr. Owen Cote of MIT just asked, what's different? Why will a surge in troops do now what it couldn't do, you know, before?
I don't believe that the surge is the critical element in this new approach. What's critical and what is new, although it's shocking that it should come this late in the engagement in Iraq, is the idea that we are going to secure the population, at least in Baghdad, to the point where people feel safe enough to work with the elected government of Iraq. They have not felt safe enough up until now. We've been getting very little cooperation by people who are frightened and intimidated, and understandably so.
Well, you say it's new that the Bush administration is looking to do that, but do you believe that Prime Minister al-Maliki will now do what he hasn't been able to do before, rein in, even arrest, or possibly kill the Shia militants who put him in office?
Well, I think it goes too far to say the Shia militants put him in office.
We
had actually rather a lot to do with his winding up in office, foolishly, in my view. We shouldn't have been intervening in domestic Iraqi politics to the degree we did, but that's water under the bridge. American forces and Iraqi forces will be operating in much closer proximity, integrated more fully, and that should make it far more difficult for the extremists to operate as they have been operating.
But it, you know, as you know, this gets to what people say is the political question rather than the military question. Do you think that this government, this Iraqi government that's in place, even with the soldiers that are going in to supplement the Iraqi troops, that they're going to be able to do things like go into Sadr City? NPR is reporting rumors of militants in Sadr City going from door to door, handing out grenades to families that are already well-armed. We heard yesterday from reporters in Baghdad saying sect militants on both sides of the equation are hunkering down. Do you think those people are going to be able to be addressed?
Well, I think the underlying basis for much of the militancy is fear on both sides, fear of attack, which causes people to arm themselves or abandon territory that is then taken over, a vacuum filled by other militants. Look, I can't be sure, no one can be sure that this will work. What is very clear is that the path we were on was not going to work, was not going to produce a stable enough situation for an Iraqi government that is representative to emerge.
You know, and the new language seems to be, and you just gave us some thoughts about Prime Minister Maliki, the new language seems to be it's the Iraqis' fault. But by and large, Iraqis in Iraq did not ask for this war. Prior to the invasion, analysts were saying that one of the only things holding Iraq together was Saddam Hussein. The sectarian divisions are historic. So why is it their fault that it's not working now? Isn't that just an attempt to shift blame?
Well, I didn't say it was their fault.
Oh, I'm saying we've read it in other places, too. Paul Bremer, for instance. Others are saying, well, the president last night saying it's the Iraqis who have to fix this.
Well, you can ask Bremer what he thinks by that, by his remarks. I think Bremer did a lot of damage.
Well, let me just ask you, do you think there is a blame shift going on here?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't. Look, I think the president is looking for a solution. And there are those who believe that it's hopeless and therefore they don't want to try any solution. And there are those who I believe underestimate the consequences of bailing out and are eager to bail out. I was very disappointed last night in the response from the Democrats because there was nothing constructive in what they were suggesting. They certainly weren't proposing a way out.
Richard Pearl, we got about a minute till a break, and I hope you can hold on for us, but how responsible do you feel? You and others on the Defense Policy Board told the president that invading Iraq would be, in the words of Kenneth Edelman, a cakewalk?
No, we didn't. Why are you attributing remarks to me that I didn't make?
I said, according to Kenneth Edelman, a fellow on the defense
you
board.
You said you and others.
Well, you and others
and
put...
And then you quote Ken. I'm really getting very tired of this. I will stand by, and where I need to say I was wrong, say that, the things I said, but not the things that other people said.
You know what, Richard Pearl? We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'd love to know what you think you said that was wrong and felt that was wrong, and also what you think can happen in the future as we go forward. How's about that?
That's fair enough.
Richard Pearl stays with us. So does Dr. Owen Katay from MIT. Day after reaction to President Bush's new way forward in Iraq. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with Dr. Owen Katay from MIT, who's going to be giving us more of his thoughts on President Bush's plan for Iraq. But we also have on the line Richard Pearl, who was a big backer of the war initially. And we want to continue to talk about what he sees in the future. He's a member of the American Enterprise Institute. The Institute had a hand in shaping some of President Bush's thoughts last night. We want to talk more about that. But let's continue to talk about what you've called that water under the bridge, Richard. It is important to some people. And you, for instance, early on advocated for going into Iraq with as few as 40,000 troops at one point?
I didn't.
What was your thinking?
What you're referring to is something I said and wrote about in 1989. And the strategy then was not sending American troops in. It was working with the opposition in Iraq. And I believed then that if the opposition in Iraq were properly mobilized, 40,000 Americans backing them up would be sufficient to bring down Saddam's regime. So it was not at all a suggestion that 40,000 Americans could go into Iraq by themselves and bring down the regime.
Well, last night President Bush acknowledged that there were mistakes made in the war. Was one of them listening to people who seemed to be overzealously interested in it?
No, I don't think if had the people I think you're referring to been listened to, we would have pursued a very different set of policies. For example, we would not have gotten into a protracted occupation, because I think most of the people you have in mind were arguing that we should turn Iraq over to the Iraqis more or less immediately. Indeed, many of us argued for supporting a government in exile even before we went in, so that at the moment Saddam fell, there would be an interim government able to take over. We didn't do that. Just to remind you, there was virtually no insurgency for the first 5 or 6 months after Baghdad fell. And I think the American occupation was the tragic mistake in the way we handled the post-war period.
Well, and analysts prior to the war, Anthony Cordesman among them, were saying that there should have been a huge occupying force ready to go in after the invading force. Richard Pearl, before I turn to Owen Cote and bring him back in, what do you think happens now? Do you think it's possible to turn around with the president's plan, to turn around what's happening in Iraq?
I think it's certainly possible. I wouldn't support it if I thought it were impossible. It's not going to be easy, and it's by no means guaranteed. But the results that would flow from any other suggestion I've heard are almost certain to be worse.
Owen Cote, step off on that, because you were saying earlier you were disappointed in the president's plan, but is there a better one?
Well, I was struck by the comparison between the main recommendations that came out of last night's speech and the Iraq Study Group. And the Iraq Study Group's, to me, their main recommendation was to start a process of withdrawing American combat forces that wasn't guaranteed to lead to their complete withdrawal, as a way to incentivize the al-Maliki government and to make some of the four ones that were mentioned by the president last night, an oil deal, changes to the Constitution that will be more amenable to the Sunnis, reversal to some extent of some of the de-Ba'athification things, and a law against militias. Well, all those things are really important. How do you incentivize the al-Maliki government to pursue those very difficult tasks? And I was struck by the idea that the best incentive would be to say, sort of, look, this, you have to do this. So how does it make sense for us to actually double down, right, and send more forces? The military commanders don't believe that that will help this problem, rather than sort of say to them, look, as a sort of sign of the fact that it's your problem, we're going to make it more of your problem, because we're not going to go up. We're going to start to go down. Now, how you respond to that incentive will affect, you know, how far down we go and what our future policies will be. But I was struck that this is the exact wrong incentive to the al-Maliki government.
And to add to that, Richard Pearl, just your thoughts on this. David Brooks writes today that al-Maliki had actually asked for U.S. troops to go to the perimeter of the city so that they could try to handle some of this initially but still have troops on standby. Your thoughts about, you know, was that a lost opportunity to... Would that have been better leverage to say we're leaving, or we're going to be on the outskirts, or we're going to start to draw down unless you do A, B, and C?
Well, you're assuming that we don't have some reasonable understanding with the government in Iraq, and I wouldn't assume that. It may be that we don't, but the way to achieve that sort of understanding, I think, is through what we would normally regard as a diplomatic process. And to believe that you've got to hit them over the head and start withdrawing troops to, what, shock, frighten them into taking actions that it's hard for them to take, I think that's a very crude instrument. And I'm a little surprised to hear that recommendation coming from people who at the same time talk endlessly about the potential of diplomacy.
Well, and speaking of diplomacy, last night the president talked tough about Iran and Syria, arms and militants coming across the border. Richard Pearl at the American Enterprise Institute, what's the conversation about what happens next there, especially since the Iraq Study Group had recommended diplomacy?
Well, I don't think diplomacy has a prayer in either case. The Iranians and the Syrians are contributing to the problem in Iraq. They're doing so because they think that's in their interest. We're not going to talk them out of that. The president was pretty opaque about what he had in mind, although the reference, the recognition that they are operating against the Iraqi government and against stability in Iraq is a good place to start. I hope it's followed up by some serious policy development, but we haven't seen that yet.
Dr. Owen Cote, got about a minute left. Your last thoughts.
Well, I was struck by Secretary Gates' comments this morning, which saying that we're going to know pretty quickly how the al-Maliki government responds to some of these very serious challenges. And so I'm not sure whether that means that there's some serious conditionality here that may actually come into play in as this surge is unfolding.
Right.
But that's one of the question marks I took from these comments this morning.
In other words, next week we could have different news. Dr. Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, thank you so much. Richard Pearl, former Assistant Secretary of Defense and now resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Richard, thank you to you as well.
All the best.
Stay ahead. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The search for a new president of Harvard University is down to a handful of candidates, and two of the four are women. So the world of academics is watching closely to see if the school will break its 371-year tradition and make a woman president, especially in light of the fact that the last president left under fierce criticism that he questioned the abilities of women in the field of science. Marcella Bombardieri has been covering the story for the Boston Globe. She joins us now. And Marcella, former president Lawrence Summers resigned about a year ago after five pretty stormy years that resulted in a vote of no confidence by the faculty. So here we are with these four candidates. Who are they?
Three of the people on the shortlist are Harvard insiders. They include the provost, Steve Hyman, the dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, Drew Faust, and that is sort of what used to be Radcliffe College, and the third is the dean of the law school, Elena Kagan.
So those three are insiders.
Right.
And who's the fourth top contender whose name you have?
His name is Tom Check, and he's the head of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and he's a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry.
Okay. So the two females there are Elena Kagan, the dean of the law school, and Drew Faust, dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Now, we know that there are a number of women presidents at major universities, Shirley Tilghman at Princeton, Ruth Simmons at Brown, Amy Gutman at the University of Pennsylvania. Why is this such a big deal, and it seems to be, that Harvard might name a woman?
Right. Well, I think that people really look to Harvard. It is the most famous university. People are fascinated by it. It has never had a woman president, so I think it would certainly get a lot of attention if Harvard named a woman. I think internally at Harvard it's less important. I think that there are certainly faculty and students and alumni who would love to see that, especially given the controversy over Larry Summers' remarks about women.
Well, let's remind ourselves, former President Lawrence Summers said that innate ability might be why there are less women than men at the highest ranks of science and medicine in universities. That sparked a firestorm. But it was a, you know, brush fire that was already going, if you will. And you say that there might not be that much excitement within the school. But correct me if I'm wrong. I thought that one of his issues was with women professors who felt they weren't getting, for instance, tenure as quickly as men.
Oh, absolutely. That was a huge problem for Larry Summers. He, the number of women who were getting tenure in the most sort of the biggest and most important school of Harvard, the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, declined for several years in a row under his tenure. And people were very upset at him for saying that. They thought it was very damaging. However, he is gone, and if a man came in who is seen as being good on women in science, I think that people would be fine with that.
Well, regardless of gender, why would anyone want to take the top spot and be on the hot seat at this school or any other? We've seen a rash of exits of school presidents spurred by faculty and student protests at Harvard, Case Western University, Gallaudet University, Baylor University. And at Harvard, by the way, there are other issues as well, bruised feelings, for instance, in the African-American Studies Department. So why would someone want this job?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are definitely some people who don't want the job, and that may be because they think that being a university president does involve too many headaches. It's really a completely around the clock job. You are, you know, you're going to be assailed by everyone for something at some point. On the other hand, it is still a huge amount of sort of authority to shape the direction that the country is going in important areas like science, to be a national leader and spokesperson, and it is Harvard.
Quick question for you, Marcella. If, in fact, a woman is chosen, might she be dogged by accusations that it's just a symbolic choice, that it was just to reverse Lawrence Summers' statements, and it might be seen as more of a figurehead than, you know, the real position?
I think that is a little bit of a worry. I think that's why the people involved in the search, you know, are not making that a top priority. I think they think it would be nice, but, you know, they're not going to pick someone who doesn't seem like the best because it's a woman. So I think if they have someone who everyone loves and is just seen as outstanding, you know, they might get some complaints from bloggers, but they'll, you know, people will respect her.
Marcella Bombardieri, a reporter with the Boston Globe, on Harvard's search for a new president. Marcella, thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you, Robin. I really appreciate it.
Well, is a woman president in Harvard's future? Does it matter? We pose those questions now to Mary D. Weniger. She's the founder of the Madison, Wisconsin-based Women in Higher Education, and she joins us from the studios of WERN in Madison. Mary D., welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Mary, you say Deans Kagan and Faust, the two women being considered, are more than qualified for the post. And in the case of Faust, an appointment to lead Harvard would be ironically symbolic. Why is that?
I do know that Drew Faust represents Radcliffe University, which was started because Harvard originally would not let women in. In fact, women had to climb in, literally climb in the windows of the classroom in order to go to some of their classes, because they were not welcome on campus. In fact, a woman who writes for me, Sarah Cook, went to Harvard. She was not allowed in the university's library because they thought that this would distract the male students. So in a way, naming somebody who represents Radcliffe now would be a great payback. The other one, Alina Kagan, as their dean of the law school, has done a tremendous job. She led a group that reevaluated whether the case method for studying law was the best way to study it, and the group came up with the fact that, no, we've only been doing this for 130 years. Is there another way to do it? Yes, there is. The other thing she did was she changed the calendar for the law school so that the first-year students could take their exams before winter break. Hallelujah! They could actually have a winter holiday.
We should say Lawrence Summers was popular with many students at Harvard and also with some of the faculty who still defend him. Some say his problem was that he didn't come from within an academic setting, and these two women do.
The two men that they're considering also come from an academic setting. And I think that's part of the problem, too, that if you don't understand the academic culture, you don't understand what people expect, you don't understand that when you say the wrong thing, you offend people, certainly not on purpose, but it happens.
Mary D. Weniger is the founder and editor of the newsletter Women in Higher Education, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you for the invitation.
And this footnote to that story, according to the Harvard Crimson, former Harvard president Lawrence Summers is, quote, dead meat, at least at Bartley's Burger Cottage. That's the popular sandwich place just beyond the walls of Harvard Square. They've scrapped the Larry Summers burger from their menu after 2.5 years. Naming burgers after celebrities and political leaders has been a tradition at Bartley since the early 1970s when Nixon and Carter ate there. Owner Joe Bartley said the Summers burger, which was topped with Swiss cheese and honey mustard, was cut because Summers had stopped making headlines. After learning that his patty was retired, Summers told the Crimson, I hope they still let me eat there. Stay with us, much more to come. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. President Bush will meet with troops today at Fort Benning, Georgia. Tina Smorrow's 25-year-old son, Nick, is an Army sergeant based at Fort Benning. His unit was supposed to head to California for a one-month training mission, but now they're being told they may be deployed to Baghdad sooner. Tina is a member of Military Families Speak Out, an organization opposed to the war, and she joins us on the line from just outside of Albany, New York. And Tina, given the group you're in, I think I can guess your answer to the question, what do you think of the president's plan and its impact on your son?
Well, the president's plan is nothing that the American people haven't already heard. At the beginning of this war, there was 160,000 troops that were deployed to Iraq, and now we're going back to 160,000 troops again. But the thing is, he's going to do it in spurts, which means if people followed the news like I did last night, that in each area of Iraq, there's only going to be 5,000 additional troops. Is that enough to adequately support our troops? In my opinion, no, it is not. Bush is trying to boost morale, and the American people have had enough of it. Our troops deserve to come home.
Tina, does your son feel the same way?
My son feels the same way, and the first time my son was deployed over to Iraq, he came home and he said to me, "Mom, I don't even know why we're there." And that is what a lot of the American people feel. Why are we there? He's scared this time.
You don't think the answer of, to hold this country together so that this turmoil doesn't spill over into the entire region is a good enough answer?
No, absolutely not. A lot of people are scared that this may even dig us in deeper. I think Bush is possibly going to turn this into a world war. Bush talks about this advanced training for the Iraqi soldiers. Well, what about this training for the American soldiers? My son was supposed to be on a month-long simulation in a desert, and now my son tells me that possibly they may be deployed even sooner. Possibly only have training for 2 weeks.
Well, let's talk about your son. He was in Iraq for close to a year. He came back July 6th. And it's supposed to be a year before he's redeployed, but he transferred to a different unit. Is that why he might be redeployed sooner?
I don't know that to be absolute. I'm assuming that is the reason why.
Well, I'm wondering, given that, the new Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, had a press conference today. He said the standard for the Army is 1 year deployed, 2 years back home. Obviously, your own son has had less turnaround time than that. But do you find any comfort in the fact that Gates also said the military is now going to be expanded, 90,000 or so troops added, and that means more troops and perhaps fewer deployments somewhere in the future?
How can he actually even adhere to that? Our troops are run ragged. There's not enough troops to adequately redeploy and redeploy, which means the same troops are being deployed even sooner.
And you don't think that there's going to be an ability to beef up the troops in time to help out your son?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. They're drained. They're tired. They're overworked, underpaid.
Well, Tina, we heard other voices today. I heard a soldier who said, "It's about time. Let's go. Let's get it done." Soldiers watching the president in Iraq speak last night saying, "We've been asking for more troops all along." When there is division like that, do you worry that it becomes even more dangerous for your son?
I do. I think I would feel better, Robin, if President Bush said, okay, 21,000 troops are going to be redeployed. Do it all at once and then start bringing everybody home. In spurts, to me, just means more casualties. President Bush said it last night, more bloodshed. How many more mothers have to have a knock on their door?
Is it tough for you where you live, by the way, upstate New York? What's the sentiment there?
I can tell you how many troops have lost their lives, and people don't want to hear it. I don't know if it's because they don't know what to say. I think it hits harder if you have a family member in the military. It baffles me.
Tina Smorrow, her 25-year-old son Nick, is an Army sergeant based at Fort Benning, Georgia. President Bush is visiting there today, and her son has word that he may soon be deployed to Baghdad as part of the new surge. Tina, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
And best to you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Question, how many Elvises does it take to run a marathon? Well, if it's the new Las Vegas Marathon, the answer is approximately 75, along with 25 couples getting married on the course, a handful of showgirls, and 16,000 other competitors, including the country's top athletes. Elvis would have turned 71 this week, and as our present, we bring you this report from Here and Now's Karen Miller-Medson, who ran this year's race, dressed as a runner. She started race weekend at the Runners Expo 2 days before the marathon.
The costume's actually handmade, so it has a little bit less bell-bottoms, a little bit more lycra to help there in the running. And besides that, just a little bit of homemade little flair and a little bit of attention just to get down the strip without freezing, but still doing honor to the king.
That's David Sampson, my first Elvis of the day. He's standing beside a booth selling ASICS sneakers. He's skinny and fit-looking, definitely a young Elvis. And he's sporting sideburns and sunglasses that do the king proud. As we're chatting, other Elvises trickle in. I ask him whether his costume might chafe.
You know, that was one of my big worries. I've been running around the neighborhood getting weird looks and strange honks. Luckily, no chafing, so we're looking good.
We run with blow-up guitars for about 10 miles, as much as long as we can. And the wig, if it's not too windy, should stay on, hopefully.
Now, when you're not Elvis, and I can't even imagine you not being Elvis, what do you do in the rest of your life?
Well, every now and then I teach first graders, but I told some of them that I was going to be doing this, and even the six-year-old said, "Miss Hotelling, that sounds ridiculous."
I hear you're the head Elvis.
I am the leader of the Elvis contingents. We have about 75 Elvises from all over the globe who will be running on Sunday. Largest contingent of Elvises, I think, anywhere, anytime, running.
So describe your suit for me. Tell me about it. Where'd you get it?
This particular one is white lycra, full length, arms and legs. We've got the red tassels down both arms and the bell bottoms on the legs with not only the red on the bottom, but also the leopard print, which adds a little style. Elvis is always a man of style.
And your wig.
The wig is actually, the pompadour is pretty sweet, because what's great about the pompadour is while you're running, and people always think that you're crazy to run in this stuff, but actually it's really comfortable, because when you run through the aid station, you throw water on your lycra, and it keeps your body cool. You don't have to worry about getting sunburned or anything. And then the wig, I just take the wig off and pour water on my head, put my wig back on, boom, ready to go. Keeps you cool. We have a baby jogger, and the baby jogger actually has a car battery that powers the boombox that has Elvis songs the entire way, plus we have a cooler with beer in it. So, and we usually stop for donuts and burgers along the way.
A little further prodding reveals that the head Elvis, whose name is really Bob Babbitt, is no athletic slouch. He's been inducted into the Iron Man Hall of Fame, and he publishes Competitor magazine. But before I can find out more, he's off to conduct the day's Elvis pep rally.
Elvises, are we ready? We're going to start with our finger exercise, and we'd love all you guys to join in. Left finger up. We're going to do 5 repeats here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Make the last one hurt. Go on the right. 1, 2, 3.
Well, if the Friday pep rally is a little unusual, Saturday's is downright surreal. The showgirls, the marrying couples, and perhaps most oddly, Robin Leach, host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, join the Elvises on stage. Leach is dressed in a black sequin t-shirt. He takes the mic.
Now, one of the fascinating things is that amongst that group tomorrow, there will be 25 couples who will either be getting married, why, I've no idea, and some of them will be renewing their vows, why, I have no idea. But the Las Vegas Marathon has created a run-through wedding chapel at mile 5.
So can I get your names?
I'm Dave Stout.
Vicky Schwent.
Now, there's a lot of choices of places people can get married. Why are you getting married on the course of running 26.2 miles?
Well, I met him in the Kansas City Marathon 3 years ago, so we thought, why not get married on during a run?
Tell me the logistics of this. How does this work since I didn't get married on a marathon course?
Well, as far as I understand, we run 5.5 miles, and then we stop, get married, and then complete the course.
What does the ceremony look like? What does it consist of? Who does it?
I'm not sure. I'm hoping.
We think it's the running reverend.
Yes, running reverend.
That's what we heard. Yeah.
Now, I heard that 75 Elvises are going to be your witnesses.
I see the Elvises everywhere I look, you know, so it's like either Elvis or Santa Claus will be there, which is good, because both are real, right? People that are alive and, real witnesses, right? Good.
Among the crowd watching and eating wedding cake are Sue and Helen from Ottawa, Canada. Helen describes her running gear.
It's kind of like a sexy Santa outfit. Got a bright pink satin Santa hat and a pink
matching bra
and little skirt with fur around the bottom and fishnet tights.
Now, I have to ask, you two will be running a marathon tomorrow.
That's right, yes, we will.
In these outfits?
In these outfits. Yes.
With our running shoes.
Why?
Well, we heard about the Elvis and Showgirl category, and in a silly moment over coffee one day, we decided we were going to do it.
That night, I'm invited to a pre-marathon dinner by the head Elvis, clearly an offer not to be refused. Over dinner at the all-you-can-eat buffet, several dozen Elvi and Showgirls eat, sing, and plan their race strategies. By 7:30, we disperse and go to sleep, only to meet up before sunrise on race day.
So it's just before 5 in the morning, and there's the Elvises are starting to congregate. They've all got their sneakers on. They're blowing up their plastic guitars, got their glasses on. How are you feeling this morning?
Doing all right. Doing good. Feeling good, Mama. Feeling good.
Ready to run 26.2?
Oh, we'll work on it. It'll be achy-breaky, but it'll be great.
How about you? You're the head, Elvis. Are you all ready to run?
Absolutely. We're, everybody's meditating right now. It's a real nervous time for the Elvises. This is, you know, we're really scared to be able to go out with this. Yeah, that's what we're wondering, because we haven't seen the cooler with the beer yet, so we're a little concerned. And the showgirls are here, which is really important. But the Elvises, we're just getting our stuff on, making sure the sideburns look good, the usual.
All assembled, the Elvi and their boombox head out to the starting line. The media gathers around us, snapping pictures. Young women scream for autographs. And I wonder whether the elite athletes warming up at the starting line feel unappreciated. It is, after all, their big day. Like at all marathons, the starting line is chaotic. 16,000 runners are lined up in the starting corrals, shivering and ready. And then we start.
Ladies and gentlemen, the new Las Vegas Marathon has begun!
In all my years of running, I've never seen anything quite like it. The Las Vegas Strip, still dark, is lit up by millions of lights and fireworks. The crowds are cheering wildly. Just over 2 hours later, the front runner, Joseph Gehegu of Kenya, breaks the finishing tape. Well, it's another hour and 45 minutes before I cross the finish line at 3:58:37. That's 7 minutes over my Boston Marathon qualifying time. The race was grueling, with winds over 30 miles an hour on some parts of the course. But at least I beat the Elvises, right? Well, actually, I don't even have those bragging rights. It turns out that David Sampson, you know, the skinny one with the impressive sideburns, well, he breezed through the finish at 3:55, a full 3 minutes before me, without even messing up his pompadour.
Here now is Karen Miller-Medson, produced our segment on the new Las Vegas Marathon.
Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! How I wish that there were more.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
If there were 40 more, I wouldn't sleep a minute away. Oh, there's blackjack and poker and the roulette wheel.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.